Welcome to World Policy on Air, a weekly podcast from the pages and website of World Policy Journal, published by the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. I'm David Alpern. In this week's program, posted April 28, 2017, after the first round of presidential voting in France, we talk with Terry E. Givens, provost and professor of political science at Silicon Valley's Menlo Park College. Her article in the new WPJ Spring issue is headlined, How the Left Can Write Itself. We'll also point out other top features in the new issue, cover line Fascism Rising. But first, this week's winners and losers report from Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, Global Risk Consultants.
I got the Trump 100 Days Winners and Losers Edition, Mexico loser. It's paying for the wall. Trump can't get away from it and all the NAFTA stuff. Canada loser. Add to that soft lumber. Who knew we'd declare war in Canada? UK winner. Come on. I mean, you know, Brexit at the end of the day, May looks pretty solid. No problems with this Trump meeting. North Korea winner. They love being in the headlines. And China winner. They bought themselves another 100 days.
You're listening to World Policy on Air. Now this.
L'assassin, c'est l'idéologie qui porte et au nom de laquelle le terrorisme tue. C'est le fondamentalisme islamiste.
Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right French National Front, was earlier than most to blame Islamist fundamentalism as the ideology behind the Paris massacre of 2015 and the fatal shooting of a policeman on the Champs-Élysées, for which the Islamic State took credit last week, was seen by many as an 11th-hour boost to her prospects in the first round of presidential voting days later. In fact, she finished an extremely close second, with almost 22% of the vote versus nearly 24% for neophyte centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron, ex-banker and finance minister, who quickly began drawing support from traditional right and left parties that trailed far behind. But win or lose their May 7th runoff, Le Pen has already demonstrated the growing strength of her populist, anti-establishment, anti-immigrant, anti-EU following in France. And that has provided yet another example of the right-wing tide sweeping through, if not yet fully over, the continent. Indeed, some analysts saw any ultimate triumph by Le Pen leading to a French exit from the European Union, so-called Frexit, or more likely, crippling internal opposition by Paris to key EU policies. A right-wing revival in Europe and the United States, and how progressives can fight it, is considered in the new WPJ Spring issue by Terry E. Givens, provost and political science professor at Silicon Valley's Menlo Park College. Her article is headlined, How the Left Can Write Itself, and we discussed it just days ago for this podcast. Professor Givens, welcome to World Policy on Air.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
How surprised were you by the outcome of first-round voting in France?
Not surprised at all by the result, except for the fact that the results were incredibly close to the polling. And I think the U.S. and British polling firms need to take lessons from the French.
What results do you expect in the May 7 runoff?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think what's not going to be a surprise is that Macron is expected to win with Le Pen coming in, you know, second in the second round, because the, as I wrote in my book, 2005 book, Voting Radical Right in Western Europe, the mainstream left and right have consistently joined together to work against the far right, as seen in the 2002 presidential election and in legislative elections. Immediately after the results were known, most of the other candidates, with the exception of Mélenchon, urged their supporters to support Macron. And so the expectation is that he's going to win and already has a substantial lead in the polls.
And what impact from how Le Pen does in the end would you expect on the EU and on the far-right momentum across Europe?
Well, what's interesting is we've seen Geert Wilders in the Netherlands and Le Pen in France perform better than in previous elections, but not well enough to gain power. So I think there have been instances in the past where the far-right has gained power, as I've written about, but I think we're going to see continued difficulty for the right. I think we'll see continued support for the far right, but not necessarily enough for them to actually gain power. So there was a report this morning about the AfD in Germany, the far right party there, losing their leader who's running for the chancellor position, stepping down. So I think it's going to be uneven. And so I think the far right is has had some increases in support, but not necessarily enough to maintain their momentum. They are feeding on the anti-globalization and anti-immigrant trend, but I think the ultimate impact on the EU is going to be a slowdown on European integration that has already been going on, and even backwards movement in some of the Eastern European countries, but maybe even potentially a strengthening amongst the countries that are the core of the European Union.
Let's consider how the far right got to this point. Start with the tide of migration that followed World War II, first in the United Kingdom and the reaction there.
Right. In the UK, they had a flow of immigration coming from former colonies, and that led to initial conflict between immigrants and natives, including riots between different groups and so on. Through the 60s, you had Enoch Powell and his Rivers of Blood speech and conflict that went on through the 60s. And we saw the rise of Nazi groups and so on, but it kind of tempered itself until the 1990s when we saw, again, the rise of the far right, including the National Front and so on. And so we've seen conflict develop because of the tide of immigration, but in the UK, immigration was always experienced as something that was expected, that was almost a normal process because of the link to the former colonies, and people became citizens, whereas the story was a little different in other countries in Europe.
Well, talk about France and Germany in particular.
Yes, in particular in France and Germany, the immigration there was considered to be temporary because in France and Germany, they imported immigrants because of the need to rebuild their economies after World War II. And so Germany in particular was importing immigrants from places like Turkey. And so these immigrants were seen as, they were called Gastarbeiter, guest workers. And even in France, even though they had the longstanding connection with Algeria, they were still considered temporary workers. And then when they tried to stop immigration in the late 60s, early 70s, the immigration continued, and then the immigrants stayed. They did not return to their home countries.
Immigration slowed after the oil crisis in the 1970s, but picked up again after some key national court rulings. Talk about that, the growth of group identities among immigrants, and then something larger for the Muslims among them.
Right. That after the immigration slowed in the 1970s, you had courts ruling that the immigrants who stayed had the right to family reunification. And you had an interesting thing I started to see in the 80s and 90s was the shift from identifying as Algerians or Turks to identifying as Muslims. And in a sense, this kind of political identity was something that developed because of things like discrimination and a focus on immigrants as a immigrant identity. So as these groups began to grow and they began to move to places like the suburbs, as youth culture developed, you had youth developing identities with hip-hop culture and so on. You had this development of Burr culture in France and so on. Then the group identities began to pick up, and especially since they were experiencing high rates of unemployment and so on, it really impacted the types of cultures that and the focus on discrimination.
By the late 1990s, declining birth rates in Europe again created a demand for immigrant labor, but cultural prejudice opposed it. Say more about that.
Right. So since the late 1990s in particular, we've seen this increasing public opinion that has been opposed to immigration. And that's been consistent also with exactly the rise of support for far-right parties. So even though there's been this demand for labor, particularly in countries like Germany, where birth rates are declining, public opinion polls have consistently shown that people want more immigration control. And so politicians have consistently talked about immigration control, and yet their policies have not necessarily been consistently aligned with that. And so there's been this discussion in the political science literature about the inconsistency of politicians and public opinion. So politicians saying that they are for immigration control, but the policies not necessarily being in alignment with that and with public opinion. And so there's an interesting disconnect, at least during the 1990s. I think we've seen a shift in that more recently, particularly with the competition coming from the far-right parties, where we've seen a more consistent approach of being more immigration control in the 2000s.
I was surprised that you saw the right revolt actually aided by the success of center-left politicians in the UK, Germany, and the US, notably including President Bill Clinton. Explain that.
Yeah, and that was an interesting phenomenon that was happening while I was kind of in the midst of my research on the radical right in the late 1990s. You had Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and Gerhard Schröder come into power during that time, who espoused a very center-left neoliberalism that was very much wanting to have a welfare reform that tried to put people back to work. So there was this ideology about market reform and back to work focus that really was revolved around getting people off of welfare and back to work. So in the U.S., that was the welfare reform of the mid to late 1990s. In Germany, that was a policy that was revolved around getting people off of welfare and back to work. So they had these work centers where people were required to go and try to get jobs and so on. So the idea was a good idea, but unfortunately, it reduced social welfare benefits at a time when wages were stagnating, manufacturing jobs were going away, and there were few alternatives for these people. And so these people began to see the economic situation as a zero-sum game, and they were losing out. And so, unfortunately, a lot of these people were also attracted to the messages of people at the time, Jean-Marie Le Pen and other far-right politicians who were using racial and ethnic minorities as scapegoats. So unfortunately, the policies of people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and Gerhard Schröder were feeding into the messages of racist-type messages and anti-immigrant messages of the Jean-Marie Le Pens and the Republicaner at the time and the National Front of using immigrants as scapegoats, and that, the messages at the time were, oh, we have too many immigrants and every immigrant is taking a job away from a native. And so we have 300,000 immigrants and 300,000 unemployed. And so unfortunately, those neoliberal policies were a catalyst in some ways for the far right.
What might have seemed a philosophically progressive French effort to force the integration of Muslims into the culture also backfired.
Yes, absolutely, because one of the things was, if you look at the education system, was really trying to make the immigrants see themselves as French and also to integrate them into the French system. And so these children, they really believed that they were French, but once they got into high school and so on, they weren't able to, their schooling wasn't putting them into a position where they would get could get into college, and they found discrimination in housing and in jobs. So in a sense, it created a greater alienation. So in a sense, they were told they were French, but they weren't being treated like French. They were being discriminated against, and so it caused greater alienation. And so the situation was such that a lot of young people were, you know, identifying as French, but then, you know, not being treated like French. They were treated badly by the police, and so it also took away, felt like their culture was being taken away, and that they were also being told that, you know, being Muslim was not a good thing. And so there were a lot of problems with the way that the French government was trying to, you know, I put integration in quotes because it really was not a way of integrating these, especially young people. It was really a way of trying to deny that they had a culture at all.
Exploitation of racism by the right, pandering to intolerance, you call it, leaves an opening for the left along three lines. Talk first about why and how of curbing income inequality.
This is one of the critical issues of our time because, you know, if you look at the economic situation right now, inequality is just growing and growing and becoming just a hugely critical issue. And it comes down to wages and how they've stagnated over since the 1970s. And I think it's something that if we don't tackle it, it's just going to become just a worse and worse issue. So, and actually, you know, I think it's connected to the issue of unions because we know that union laborers make higher wages than non-union. And I think Germany is a good example of a country that has been able to accommodate unions and have greater income equality. And also, if you look at some countries are toying with the idea of having a minimum income, and looking at other ways to basically, you know, raise the minimum wage. I was just reading a story about how Australia has a very high minimum wage. But we have to come up with some way of making sure that everybody has a basic way, you know, to survive. You know, we've got too much homelessness, too many people who, you know, can't survive on basic housing and things like that. So, I think that that's part of the reason why we're seeing people who are so concerned about, you know, the competition at the lower levels of income. They see immigrants as competition rather than people who they should be in solidarity with. And so we need to curb income inequality in order to get away from this idea that everybody's in competition with each other and give everybody a minimum level of being able to survive and have it not be this kind of, you know, basically everybody's falling through the cracks. Not everybody, but of course, but, you know, people are just falling through the cracks. And also, you know, there's a variety of ways to try to regulate industry so that we try to reduce the differences between what the top-level employees are making and the bottom-level employees. And we know that manufacturing jobs are going away, so that's something that's going to be critical to look at and find ways to, you know, what is the new economy? You know, I'm a college professor, and we're looking at how are we training our students for the next economy. You know, I'm right in the middle of Silicon Valley, and you know, technology, of course, is one of the drivers. But you know, what's the middle in? You know, where are the middle income jobs, and how are we training our students as well as lower wage people to be ready for that economy?
In a larger sense, as we become more automated, if everybody isn't needed for production, they certainly are needed for consumption of the products that are being produced. So the notion of a minimum income is starting to make sense to a lot of people. The third pathway that you talk about is what you call common sense immigration policies. What would they look like?
the number one thing we have got to do is provide visas because the jobs are there. You know, I live, as I said, in Silicon Valley, and, you know, we talk all the time about the fact that there are jobs here for immigrants. And the problem is we don't have enough visas. And this is one of my main areas of research. And we know that the main thing we need to do for immigration reform is provide more visas. If we had more visas, we wouldn't have so many undocumented people in the country. And I tell people all the time, the number one reason we have undocumented people in the country is because we don't have enough visas. besides visas, we need to look at what we need. We need people to work in agriculture. We need people to work in, restaurants. I mean, everybody knows somebody who is working a job, whether it's in construction, whether it's in the hospitality industry. I mean, whether it's in, there's all kinds of low-wage jobs. And frankly, we need to make those low-wage jobs better paid. And the one way to do it is to make sure that these people are documented so that these people are getting paid better. So, and like you said, they can consume more. And the more they are consuming, the better off the companies are that are selling these things. They're going to be able to buy more at the grocery stores. The grocery stores are going to be able to hire more people. I mean, it's all, it all works together. And, you know, there's a lot of people are starting to understand this more. And I think there's a lot of people in industry who are saying, hey, wait a second, you know, we need to pay our people better so that they can consume more, so that they can, you know, so that they can buy our cars and so that they can buy our phones and so on. And, even with healthcare, I think you're seeing the backlash because people are like, wait a second, you know, we need our people to be healthy and be able to afford healthcare so that they can continue to work for us. And, you know, we don't want to have to worry about whether our employees can afford health care and so on. So I think we're starting to see a bit of a shift in how people are recognizing that stagnating wages and having undocumented people working for low wages is not a good thing for our economy.
While many white working class voters reject such supportive immigration policies and income policies, studies show that growing ranks of minority working class voters are not so receptive to politicians who appeal to populist views. Say more about that.
Yeah, so I think a lot of minority working class voters understand, you know, that these populist appeals are not helpful to them. They understand that immigration policy. If you look at they're not necessarily voting on the basis of even the immigration policies. They understand that there aren't easy answers to a lot of these issues. It's not just that if we just say we're going to buy American, that's going to fix everything. So we have to figure out what is it that's going to fix our economy, and it's not just to say buy American. It's like we have to find ways to, expand our manufacturing in a way that makes sense. And, you know, a lot of minority working class voters understand that we need to support education, and that we need that the government is critical to supporting things like, healthcare, and that we don't just want to cut government. So I think that's the big difference, is that minority working class voters understand the role of government and that it's important to a lot of the things that help them on a day-to-day basis, whereas a lot of white working class voters are just frustrated and think government's the problem. And that's a lot of what populist politicians are saying, or they, a lot of white working class voters just think that, the populist politicians are going to make sure that the white working class, is getting theirs, or is going to make sure that they get the benefits and, these other people don't. And that's why the anti-immigrant sentiment, we're going to keep those immigrants out and they aren't going to get the benefits or the jobs and all of that. And the minority working class voters don't necessarily, some do, but most, understand that the competition isn't going to damage them, and that, all boats can be lifted if you get the right policies in place. the demographics of this country are shifting. And so a lot of what you see among the white working class voters is this fear, it's this general fear that they're losing out. And so the minorities have been losing out for a long time, and white working class voters are just starting to get this sense that they're losing out. So there's that dynamic is starting to play itself out, and I think this is going to be an ongoing issue. Actually, I have a friend, Justin Guest, who just wrote a book about this, and I think this is a dynamic that's going to have an important role in politics going forward for a long time.
In North America, you see progressive potential by state leaders in California and New York and by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And, I think that it's one of the reasons I appreciate living in California. And it's really an interesting phenomenon that these leaders are really dominating in many different ways, things like climate change, along with a more pro-immigrant stance and being receptive to refugees and so on. And so there's a sense that, there's hope. Obviously, they give hope to progressive politics, but also that if we keep in mind that, if you look at the popular vote and what happened recently in France, that there is hope for the left to a certain extent. Not if you look at the traditional left, but that, there was a reasonable vote for left politicians more generally and progressive politicians. And so one thing that I gave three things in my article, but I think it's going to be critical that we look at what leaders are doing in places like Canada and New York and California, and what is appealing. For example, gun control is very popular in California and other issues, but also what's not working. We have a lot of economic issues in these places, and how we're dealing with things like immigration. And so there are a lot of challenges, and it's not going to be easy going forward. And I still think there's a lot of challenges for the left, even in places like California. But one thing that's helped California is that we survived the economic downturn. Jerry Brown took some really tough economic measures to help the state get through it, and that's the kind of leadership that's going to be needed.
There's also hope among U.S. Democrats that sheer incompetence by the Trump administration and rhetoric continually contradicted by actual facts may redirect all but the most loyal portions of Trump's Republican base. Is it realistic to think that things really do have to get worse before they get better?
Well, we're kind of stuck here, unfortunately. We'll have to see what happens in 2018, but we're barely 100 days in, and it's a situation where I think things will get worse before they get better, because we have to get to the next election. But broader issue is how will the left mobilize? We're starting to see, what's happening with the Democrats more generally with the new leadership, what's happening with special elections, which, it's hard to say right now because there's just been one or two. There's more coming. And so I think, I don't think it's a good idea to rely on the incompetence of the Trump administration. It's incumbent upon the left more broadly, and I mean the left not just here in the U.S., but in Europe as well, and to, be proactive. And there's been a lot of grassroots activity. You had You have the different marches, and there's a lot of activity going on in terms of people deciding to run for office at all different levels, and that's the kind of activity that's going to be important, is people taking action all the way from the school boards all the way up to running for president. That's the kind of activity that's going to make a difference, and people being proactive. It's not going to be waiting for incompetence by Trump and the congressional Republicans. It's going to be what happens on a day-to-day basis in the localities, in the states, and people deciding to run for office. And I think that's the most important thing. And we need to start making things better at every level.
Professor Givens, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Terry E. Givens is provost and professor of political science at Silicon Valley's Menlo Park College. Her books include Voting Radical Right in Western Europe from Cambridge University Press in 2005 and Legislating Equality, The Politics of Anti-Discrimination Policy in Europe from Oxford University Press in 2014. For the spring issue of World Policy Journal, cover line Fascism Rising, she wrote the article headlined How the Left Can Right Itself. Since we spoke, far-left French Unbowed movement leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who'd finished fourth in round one, held off endorsing Macron while he surveyed his disappointed followers. Quote, not one vote must go to the National Front, a Mélenchon spokesman declared, but possible abstentions could be critical. And Le Pen won a video victory with coverage of her being cheered in Macron's hometown of Amiens at a factory whose jobs are set to move to Poland, which she vowed to prevent. Macron was jeered and booed when he showed up after meeting with union representatives at the local Chamber of Commerce, but he later said he'd try to get a new buyer for the plant or arrange for job retraining. Le Pen later campaigned for right-wing Riviera votes in Nice, as one poll indicated Macron's support slipping. Featured in the new WPJ spring issue, coverline Fascism Rising, you'll find numerous views on how corruption of language and distortion of history contribute to dictatorship and how the process can best be fought. Also reports on the infrastructure of counterinsurgency, on the retro-macho politics that doomed Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and on Ukraine, buffer or flashpoint between Russia and the West. And listen next week when our podcast will consider the dangerous politics of fabricated terrorism. World Policy On Air is a production of World Policy Journal at the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. Editor Christopher Shea, online news editor Laurel Jerombeck, podcast producer Anna Grace Carter. I'm David Alpern. ¶¶